previously, in Chris's lecture and in Professor Murphy's lectures, we saw book six, Aeneas reaches Italy. He goes and he visits the underworld, guided by the Sibyl of Cumae. And there he sees the souls of the Alban kings and the souls of future famous Romans. And the soul of his father, Anchises, gives him a prophecy, which is primarily about Rome's greatness in war and the greatness of all these future Romans whose souls he's seeing. And he discusses the concept of a just war. And can anyone remind me what a just war would entail? So it's a war that has approval from the gods. It's one that is conducted under auspices. So, you know, you've gotten a sign from the gods that this is all good to go. And it's also one where you do what a proper Roman should do. You have pity on the conquered, but you crush the proud. So this is the dichotomy of war. It's good, and it's also good if you're having a just war. And Augustus, whose soul we see in the underworld, is the man to fulfill Rome's promise. So, book seven, Aeneas comes up from the underworld and he finally reaches Latium, which is where he and his descendants will settle. And Latinus, who's the king there, thinks that Aeneas is his prophesied son-in-law, prophesied by his father, or at least ancestor, Faunus. But then, of course, Juno goes and sticks her finger in the pie. She is happy so long as Aeneas is miserable. And this is what we, of course, see through the entire Aeneid. Aeneas happy, Juno sad. Aeneas unhappy, well, Juno's still not really happy, but at least she's happier. So she summons Alecto from hell. Alecto is a fury. These are furies. Notice that they have snakes and torches. And this is actually Orestes that they're pursuing. He's a figure from Greek myth. But the furies are the same no matter what. They're there to punish people who do bad things, especially people who kill their own relatives. But in this case, they're just there to instill war. So Alecto goes and she drives Amata insane. Who's Amata? The wife of Latinus. And the mother of? Lavinia. Good. Excellent. Okay, so she drives her insane with a snake, and you notice that they have snakes. But snakes are also a persistent symbol of the Aeneid. Snakes imply madness and war. What's the first snake that we see in the Aeneid, or at least one of the first snakes? Good, so that's one. And another that's shortly after that, anybody? So we've got this simile. When Pyrrhus, or Neoptolemus, kills Priam, there's a simile that he's like a snake emerging from its skin and slithering and shining all over the place. So early on, you've got these associations of snakes and war and death. And the Furies are just yet another example of that. So, now we turn to today's topic. And so first we'll go through a summary of Book 7. So first, Alecto visits Turnus in a dream. And then Alecto goads Turnus to warlust. And we'll, of course, come back to all of these. And Alecto causes Ascanius to shoot Silvia's pet deer. And Alecto rouses the Italian farmers and shepherds to war. And then Juno takes over, and she says, "Go away, Alecto, my turn." And then Latinus curses Turnus and withdraws. And then Juno opens the gates of war. And finally, in the book, we get the catalog of the Italian allies. Now, we've discussed several times how the Aeneid is kind of the Odyssey in the first half plus the Iliad in the second half. What's the theme of the Odyssey? John?
Wanderings.
Wanderings, good. And sailing and also trying to reach home. Now, in the case of Aeneas, he's also trying to reach home, but it's not his old home. It's a new future home. What's the theme of the Iliad?
War.
War. Exactly. So we can imagine that the Aeneid is going to be war in the second half. And indeed, when we get to Virgil's second invocation of the Muse, we get war. So he says, come now, Erato. And then he says, who are the kings, what happened, etc. All this I will explain. I'll recall what led to the start of the fighting. You, goddess, prompt your seer. What's a seer? A prophet. Good. So Virgil is casting himself as a prophet. And this is a role that poets from Virgil's time and onward frequently take. They're a prophet and a poet at the same time. So that's what seer means. I'll speak about hideous warfare. I'll speak of battles, of kings who were driven to their death by courage. What part Etruscans played? How Hesperia's whole land was bullied into the fight. So we get war over and over and over. But at the same time, Erato, whom he evokes up there, is actually the muse of love poetry. So we get the juxtaposition of love and war. We've seen this before. We'll see it again. So what's the next step? Alecto has brought the plot to a screeching halt. There's not going to be a marriage. There's not going to be a foundation of the Trojan settlement. But there's also not war yet. So we're just in a standstill. So she has to make a war. Turnus is the logical person to turn to. Who's Turnus?
He wants to marry Lavinia.
He wants to marry Lavinia. Has he done a lot yet? No. At this point, he hasn't done anything. He's a loose plot point. And he's also Amata's excuse for Aeneas and Lavinia not getting married. She really, really likes Turnus. He's her nephew. She also may kind of have a thing for him. So, in any case, he's there, he's hovering in the background, but he hasn't done anything himself. So, what happens? Alecto shows up, tries to get Turnus to fight, and he resists her. He struggles against her. Which begs the question, does Alecto, in some sense, create Turnus, whom we see for the rest of the Aeneid? She says, I decide wars and death with my own hand. And then she instills both love and war in Turnus. Oops. So she points a flaming brand at the youth and implanted smoke-darkened light in his heart, the torches of death and of marriage. Now, this is a translation that translates a single word in the Latin, but it's a word that can be used for the torches of death or the torches of marriage, and that's why it's translated this way. So again, we have this juxtaposition of love and war. And you can also compare Dido and Amata, both of whom have this simultaneous love and war within them. So the final step before we get to war. Alecto has a war leader and an antagonist against Aeneas, but she still needs a reason for the rest of Italy to get involved. So her solution is for Ascanius to shoot Silvia's deer. Here is Ascanius shooting the deer. It doesn't look much like an accident here, but, you know, this is some French guy's conception of it. So prior to the Trojans' arrival, Italy is pictured as peaceful and pastoral. What's pastoral? Rural, shepherds, idyllic flocks gambling about in the fields, nice, blissful, pastel colors, you know. But when the Trojans arrive, you have the introduction of war and of bloodshed. It's not that this has never been the case in Italy before, but it hasn't been for a good long while now. But more interesting in some ways, where have we seen a wounded deer before?
Dido.
Dido, exactly. The love sickness of Dido. We have the simile. Deer or human? So Dido in love. Dido, unfulfilled, burns on and, in raving obsession, randomly wanders the town, like a deer pierced through by an arrow. Hit long range when off guard in the Cretan woods by a shepherd armed for the hunt. He has left his steel-tipped shaft in her body, not knowing he's hit his mark. In her flight, she ranges all Dictys' meadows and woods. Barbed deep in her haunch is the reed that will kill her. So that's Dido's lovesickness. Now, Sylvia's wounded deer is strangely similar. It was Ascanius, fired by his love of distinguished approval, who himself leveled a shaft in the curve of his hornbow of antlers. His hand strayed, but not from the path God wanted. The arrow, torqued with a loud twang, passed through the stomach and groin of its victim. Wounded, the quadruped fled to within its familiar dwelling, entered the stables bellowing, streaming with blood, made the whole house ring with his plaintive cries, like a human begging for mercy. So you've got Dido like a deer, and you've got the deer like a human. Virgil is not being very subtle about the correlation here. The long shadow of Dido, you've got her, and also love as a wound, and love and death drawn back into the text through this simile of the wounded deer. Again, a juxtaposition of love and war, which we keep seeing. And, again, compare the invocation of Erato. Come now, Erato, muse of love poetry. Let's talk about some war. Moreover, the spirit of Dido seems to be present throughout Book 7. We've already seen similarities between Carthage and Latinus's city, which is a productive city and a lofty palace. Chris talked about that on Wednesday. And then at the end of the book, this book, we're going to get the warrior maiden Camilla, who in some ways will also recall Dido as a strong female figure. So what are the beginnings of war? We still need two elements for proper full-blown war. One is the presence of Mars, the god of war. He's first mentioned after the first blood is spilled. While this action occurred on the plains, with Mars favoring neither faction, and this is talking about the Trojans versus the Italians after the deer has been killed, he's next mentioned as Latinus's men stir for war. Husbands whose mind-blown wives are dancing for Bacchus in backwood wilds as a chorus, Amata's name, after all, carries some weight, gather from everywhere, merge in a group, chant endlessly, Mars, Mars! Some perverse force makes them want, just saying the word should be outlawed, war. They don't care that it goes against omens and fate set by heaven. So this is very clearly not a just war, right? It's against omens. It's against fate. This is the opposite of a proper Roman war. And finally, Mars emerges fully into the text as the gates of war are opened. Men had a custom in Latium's Hesperian days, which the later Alban cities adopted and hallowed. It now is the practice in mighty Rome's great empire, and by now, Virgil means, in his own time, when men rouse Mars for a new set of battles, say, for example, they're planning to bring war's tears to the Getae, notice that the translator has highlighted these first letters, which spell out Mars. This is not just something that he put into the text for fun. It's there in the Latin, too. So this is where Mars really properly comes into the text. And Mars is mentioned again right here. But what we still need is for the actual opening of the gates of war to happen. These are the gates of war, the Temple of Janus. So the gates of war are real. They're double gates on the Temple of Janus. And they're a very potent Roman symbol. When they're closed, it means that the entire Roman Empire is at peace. When they're open, it means that Rome is at war. Octavian closed the gates of Janus, so saying, we're at peace, for the first time since the Punic War. That's a long time. In 29 BC. So the fact that they're closed up until the Trojans arrive, and then they get opened, really is a very powerful symbol for Romans of Virgil's day. This is kind of like the beginning of their troubles forever. So this is Janus. And why Janus? Why are the gates part of his temple? Sorry, did you have a question?
I did. Just to clarify, prior to the gates of war being open and Mars being in the battle, is that... Prior to that, that's not a just war, but after they open the gates of war, is it?
It's not, because Latinus, whose job it is to open them, isn't the one who does it. So we'll see that. I think we'll see that in a second. But that's a good question. So Janus is the god of endings and beginnings. So end of war, beginning of war, end of the year. His name is related to the Latin word for doorway. He presides over Roman world rule, and he's also associated with chaos, the primordial being at the beginning of the universe. So he embodies the original strife, war, of the universe when everything was in conflict with each other. So Latinus refuses to open the gates and declare war. It's his job, later it's the job of the consuls. What do the consuls equate to in an earlier system? Kings, good, exactly. So Latinus, the king, later the consuls, it's their job to declare war. So Juno ends up taking matters into her own hands. But just because a god does it doesn't mean that actually the gods as a whole approve. And later Jupiter will say, no, this is just not okay, this is not what's dictated by fate. But for now, they've got war anyway. But it's not a just war. So Italy is transformed. It's no longer pastoral. Instead, it becomes a war zone. So you've got, after the gates of war are opened, motionless until now and untroubled, Ausonia, which is Italy, is blazing. So you go from untroubled and peaceful to immediately on fire and at war. And then down here, the Italians, they're making war. They're making weapons and armor. Here's where they've shifted respect for the sickle and share. That's a plowshare. Where they've transferred all love for plowing. They reforged their father's swords in the furnace. So the idea of beating swords into plowshares, going from war into peace, is here reversed. Previously, the Italians had been a warlike people. Then they come to a period of peace. This is reversing the process. And the Italians band together from all over Italy to march against the Trojans. The Trojans are proto-Romans. Does this maybe recall the social war where Rome was fighting against all of her allies? It's possible. There are certainly some very important classicists who think so. So, the Italian allies, who are listed here, they come from all over Italy. They come from here. You can see that we're just filling in the map. So this entire region is what's mentioned by Virgil in his text. They don't come from the Greek area, they don't come from Cisalpine Gaul, but everywhere else. This is Rome right here. So this is a widespread gathering of allies. The last of them is Camilla. She appears at the very end of Book 7. She's a strong female huntress, and as I said before, think about Dido. And we should also realize from the beginning that Camilla will suffer an unfortunate defeat. The Dido model, the Cleopatra model, cannot stand. It cannot succeed in this period. A Camillus, thinking about what her name sounds like, a Camillus is an acolyte to a Roman priest, and this is a little statue of a Camillus. Camilla herself is instead sworn to the goddess Diana, the goddess of hunting, a virgin goddess, but it's still a link with the divine and with cult. And her name also reminds us of Camillus. Who was Camillus? Good, good. The general who defeated the Gauls in back when Rome was invaded. And remember also that he's the one who argues... Sorry? Did you have a question? Oh, okay, sorry. He's also the one that argues against leaving Rome and going to Veii. So it's not exactly clear why Virgil connects their names, but there definitely would have been echoes of Camillus's name when we encounter Camilla. So now... Book 8. Are there any questions about Book 7 before we go on? So, in Book 8, first Aeneas is visited by the river Tiber in his sleep. He finds a prophesied white sow. He arrives at Volantium, the city of Evander. We get the story of Hercules and Cacus. Evander takes Aeneas on a tour of future Rome. Venus goes and asks Vulcan, her husband, to make armor and weapons for Aeneas. We get Aeneas' alliance with Evander and the final parting of Evander and his son Pallas. And then we have the Shield of Aeneas, with scenes of future Rome. So, Book 8 is, in many ways, the Roman book. From themes of war, we move pretty abruptly to themes of Rome. We have Roman religion, which is, for example, the worship of Hercules at the Ara Maxima, the greatest altar. We get Roman topography, so we go through an actual tour of well-known Roman landmarks. And we get Roman history. We have the founding of Alba Longa, we have the Latin League, which is the alliance of the Latin cities, and we have all the scenes on the Shield of Aeneas, these future events. We also get prophecies, or more to the point, we get the fulfillment of prophecies, both in Book 7 and in Book 8. So far, we've seen a couple prophecies already fulfilled. Creusa's prophecy to Aeneas, they will reach the Hesperian land, again, that's Italy, where the Lydian Tiber flows a straight course without waves amid farmlands fruitful and peopled. Born for you there is a blessed state, royal power and a royal partner in marriage. We haven't completely gotten this fulfilled yet. He's not actually married to Lavinia yet. He's not actually founded a city. But we're well on our way, and he's certainly reached Hesperia. And Calino's prophecy, Calino being a harpy, a foul, nasty birdwoman creature, but it's also a prophecy delivered by Anchises that the Romans are going to eat their tables. But, in fact, we know it's not as bad as it sounds. You'll be allowed to reach Italy's coast, to sail into her harbors, but you will never surround your allotted city with ramparts till dire famine, avenging the wrong done to us by slaughter, drives you to gnaw with your jaws at your tables, and then to devour them. But we know that, in fact, they simply ate the bread that was under their fruits, and then Ascanius was like, oh, hey, we're eating our tables! And so it was all okay. So Tiber shows up, and he's going to deliver another prophecy. He is the personification of Rome's local river. So here he's got a cornucopia showing that rivers are very fruitful and fertile. We've got Romulus and Remus and the she-wolf. They probably weren't there when he showed up for Aeneas. He's holding an oar. This is a symbol of naval power. So, you know, he might have looked something like this. He probably had horns on his head because rivers were generally depicted with bull horns. And he gives Aeneas a divine prophecy of what's to come. But, in fact, we've actually heard this prophecy. We haven't because we didn't read this book, but Aeneas has certainly heard this prophecy before. And this prophecy is delivered by Helenus, who is one of Aeneas's fellow Trojans, and he's the guy that founds the little mini Troy that Aeneas shows up at, and he's like, oh, it's this river that I recognize, and this one that I recognize. Anyway, so what Helenus says is that when he gets to Italy, finally, when under pressure, you come to the streams of a well-hidden river, that would be the Tiber, under the bankside's oak shrub brush, you'll find an immense sow lying sprawled on the soil on her side. An albino, with 30 newborn piglets, albino themselves, at her teats in a cluster. This is the seat for your future state and your refuge from troubles. Now he says, I'll tell you these signs, store them in your memory. So when Aeneas, in his sleep, sees an image of the Tiber who tells him the exact same thing, maybe Virgil's also inviting us to imagine that perhaps Aeneas is kind of conjuring this image up for himself. Yes, it's a divine visitation, but maybe, possibly, it's also evoking things that Aeneas already subconsciously knows. So, I mean, you can compare the fact that the Tiber also tells him a little bit about Evander, whom he's about to meet, but when Aeneas actually meets Evander, he seems to know a lot more about Evander's ancestry than the Tiber has just told him in the dream. So, again, maybe this is actually things that Aeneas already knows coming back to him. So, what Helenus and the Tiber both say is that Aeneas is going to find this pig. This pig. And, in fact, he does. And she has 30 piglets, just as they both say. Alba means white, and hence the name of Alba Longa, which is the city that Aeneas' son, Ascanius, will found in this spot. What do these things stand for? The 30 years until Ascanius founds Alba Longa, but also possibly the 30 allied cities of the Latin League, which Rome will eventually destroy, and Aeneas does sacrifice all 30 of the piglets. There may be some intimations of Rome's more side rather than her more lenient side around here. I'm sure that the Latin League entirely deserved it. In either case, it's a powerful symbol of Rome's hegemony, her leadership, her rule. An alternative version is here in this picture. Aeneas and Ascanius discover the white sow. Here's the sow. And here's Ascanius and Aeneas and their ship. We have to remember always that Virgil is picking a version when there are actually lots of possible versions. So he's choosing a version for a reason, and the people around him will also know the other versions that he's maybe not choosing. So, Rome. Rome then and Rome now. That should have been, there's no place like Rome. Aeneas finally arrives at Rome. In other traditions, again, Aeneas founds Rome. But even though he doesn't do so in the Aeneid, he still has to visit Rome. You can't have the great Roman epic without Rome showing up. And his arrival is also the culmination of multiple prophecies. The prophecy of Creusa, the prophecy of Helenus, the Sibyl, Anchises, ad nauseum. Augustan Rome is the teleological goal of the Aeneid. Does anyone know what teleological means? Good. It explains a purpose for which something happens. It's the endpoint, the ultimate endpoint that everything is moving towards. So Augustan Rome is that distant, purposeful endpoint of the Aeneid. Evander's Rome, which we see in the Aeneid, is both very different from and very similar to Augustan Rome. So how is it different? It's bucolic. Evander's Rome is a bucolic landscape. Bucolic is very similar to pastoral. So you can compare the rest of Italy in Book 7. Evander himself comes from Arcadia. Where's Arcadia? Approximately? The Peloponnese in Greece. Good. So here, it's right in the middle of the Peloponnese. And Arcadia is the bucolic spot par excellence of Greece. So Evander, who's from there and now lives in equally bucolic Rome, says that the first people of Latium, the area around Rome, were hunter-gatherers, just like the first Arcadians, who sometimes get called acorn eaters because they didn't farm, they just lived off the land. Hercules also arrived in this area while herding cattle, and bucolic literally means cattle tending. So Hercules driving cattle through the spot of Rome just adds to the bucolic associations of the area. Obviously, this image is very different from citified Augustan Rome. So we get the Golden Age, the idea of the Golden Age, which is a concept that creates a link between early Rome and Augustus's Rome, and we'll see why. So the Golden Age is the original period of peace and pre-agricultural prosperity under the reign of Saturn. Who's Saturn? Jupiter's dad. Good. Also, of course, a planet with rings, but in this case, Jupiter's dad. And Jupiter defeats his father. He overthrows him. And he brings on the war-filled Silver Age and Iron Age. But Saturn goes to Italy. So the Golden Age essentially lasts there for longer than it does in the rest of the world. Italy is essentially in a permanent golden age until outsiders arrive. For example, the Ausonians and the Sicanian peoples. Aeneas and the Trojans are, in other words, just the last in a long series of outsiders who arrive late. But the reign of Augustus is frequently depicted as a new golden age, which brings us full circle. It's a time of peace, right? He closed the gates of Janus. He closed the gates of war. And he's rehabilitating all of these divine cults and building all of these new temples and making all of these brick temples into marble temples and making Rome really pretty and happy. And so we've got this link that's formed. He essentially restores Rome and Italy to its original state of peace. Virgil is showing us an overlapping double vision of Rome here, the then and the now, but sometimes the then and the now are kind of similar. Other parallels with the Augustan age. We have the Feast of Hercules. This is a yearly sacrifice at the Ara Maxima, the greatest altar. It's originally tended by the Potitii and the Pinarii, whom we see in the text. But in Augustus's day, this is a state cult. Virgil fuses the two for the purposes of the Aeneid, because although we do see the Potitii and the Pinarii, we also have this kind of as a state cult. Evander is presiding over it. We also have the presence of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill. There's a major temple of Jupiter, Optimus Maximus, the best and greatest, on the Capitoline, which is the seat of Rome power. And Evander's city is called Pallantium. Now, on the one hand, it's named after his son, and also his grandfather, but also, Virgil may be suggesting that this is the derivation of the Palatine Hill. And the Palatine is the seat of Augustus's power. So we have this transference from the Capitoline to the Palatine during Augustus's day. And we have both of them being prominent back in Evander's Rome. So this is where the sacrifice is taking place, the Forum Boarium down here. Here's the Capitoline, here's the Palatine, here's the Aventine, which is where Cacus's was. Here's the River Tiber, and here's Rome. Here we have it again. So here's a little round temple, here's another little round temple. This one is definitely a temple of Hercules, this one may be. And here is the Ara Maxima. This is another view. You see the Tiber, and here's the Capitol, the Capitoline, round temple, Ara Maxima, and you can see the Palatine. Here's what it looks like today. There weren't cars back then. And here is Hercules. This Hercules is probably the Hercules that Virgil and Virgil's readers would have had in mind for this scene, because this is the cult statue, probably, of the Hercules from the Forum Boarium. So his temple in the Forum Boarium, this is where the statue was discovered. It's gilded in gold. It's made out of bronze. Look how huge it is. Here's little people. And it's from the 2nd century BC, so we know that it must have been around in Virgil's day. And there's another very similar statue, which was also discovered not too far away. So this is kind of how they would have had Hercules in their mind. And they take a tour of Rome. So they see the Ara Maxima and the Gate of Carmentis, Romulus's Asylum, which is partway up the Capitoline. You see the Lupercal, where Romulus and Remus will be raised by the wolf. They see the Argiletum, which is a steep pathway up to the Palatine. They see the Tarpeian Rock, which is part of the Capitoline, and it's where criminals were thrown off of. It's very steep. They also see the Capitol itself. They see the Forum Romanum here. And then they can all see it way far away, the Carinae. Now, the Forum Boarium is a cattle market, and that's why it also talks about them hearing cattle mooing when they're walking around here, because they can hear the cattle that are theoretically already here. Cosmic effects! And this is what we'll be talking about essentially for the rest of today. So we have Hercules and Cacus, and we have the shield of Aeneas. The cosmos is the universe, but it's also the order of things. Hercules and Cacus. How is this a cosmic event? What is a gigantomachy?
Why?
No, in fact. That's a cosmogony. But good guess. No, a gigantomachy. Yes, exactly. So the giga bit here means giant. Think about gigabyte. They're really big. And the machi bit means battle. So this is the battle against the giants. Specifically, the battle between the giants and Olympians. And they're helped by Hercules. And this is back in the cosmic founding of the universe in some ways. It's a defeat of the forces of chaos. And it equates to a typical battle of good versus evil. Cacus, Hercules' opponent, means evil in Greek. As a side note, Evander means good man in Greek. So Cacus is also set up against Evander as the bad and the good. The two possible forces of Rome, one goes away, the other stays. So this is symbolic of Olympian order, which is represented by Hercules, against disorder, represented by Cacus. And it represents the beginning of the universe in a few ways. First of all, you've got the gigantomachy aspect, but also it represents in some ways the beginning of Rome. The worship of Hercules, which happens after he defeats Cacus, is Rome's very oldest cult. So we see the beginning of Roman worship of God here. And Rome, of course, is the center of the universe, as everybody knows. So the shield of Aeneas now. In the Iliad, what's the Iliad? Is it a poem? Is it a play? Yes.
It's the epic poem that has the Trojan War.
Good. It's the epic poem written by Homer, which has the Trojan War. And as we know, it's equated to the second half of the Aeneid. So in the Iliad, Achilles' mother, and Achilles is the major Greek hero in the Trojan War, Achilles' mother Thetis, who's also a goddess, brings him new armor, forged by Hephaestus, the god of the forge, and this includes a new shield. Hephaestus' Roman name is Vulcan. They're the same god. Homer provides a long description of the images on Achilles' shield. The highlights, we've got the earth, the sea, the sky, and constellations. We've got two cities. One is at peace, with ritual order and law, and the other is at war. We also get agriculture, the sort of order that man imposes upon the earth in some ways. We get dancing, and the whole shield is surrounded by the ocean on the outside. So, traditionally, Achilles' shield was read in antiquity as a representation of the universe. After all, you've got earth, sea, sky, constellations, you've got ocean, and of course, ocean goes around the entire world, just like some of our ancient people thought. So if we compare Aeneas' shield with Achilles' shield, well, we get Vulcan or Hephaestus forging new weapons and armor for the hero. We have the goddess mother, either Venus or Thetis, bringing new weapons to her son. We've got a prolonged description of the shield. It makes sense that if Achilles' shield is a representation of the cosmos, the universe, then so might Aeneas' be. But all the images on the shield are of Rome's history. Again, maybe Rome is the center of the universe. Certainly, the Romans thought so. Here's the shield, sort of. We've got pictures around the outside. We've got the Battle of Actium on the inside. So we start here with Romulus and Remus. We get the Rape of the Sabines. We get a battle with Titus Tatius. We get a treaty with Titus Tatius. We have the punishment of Metius Fufetius, who was drawn and quartered. Livy tells us that this was the only time anyone was punished that way because it was so horrible to be dragged into pieces by horses. We have the fight against Lars Porsena, Horatius at the bridge, which was one of the very first things you guys read. It's the first passage in As the Romans Did. We also have Cloelia swimming across the river at the same point. We get the invasion of the Gauls and the defense of Rome against the Gauls by Manlius, who gets warned by the geese. We have then institutions of Roman religion. We have the Salian priests, the dancing priests of Mars, and they dance around with these little shields that fell from the sky. Strangely, like Aeneas' shield, we may remember. And we have the women of Rome in chariots with ritual cult objects. And then we move all the way down to Hades, the underworld. And we get the punishment of Catiline. This is not something that Virgil showed us when Aeneas was in the underworld himself. we get a slightly different view of Rome here. There, all of the sinners were Greek mythological heroes. Here, we start seeing that there are maybe two possible sides of Rome. Not all of Rome is great and glorious. But we also see Cato giving laws, and Cato is very wise and just, as we all know. So, in the center, then, we have the Battle of Actium. We have Augustus leading the combat. Then we have Agrippa leading the combat. One of these is slightly more true than the other. Antony is backed by Egyptian wealth and Egyptian gods. We also get Roman gods, Neptune and Venus and Minerva and Apollo. We then also get gods of war. We get Mars and Discord and Bellona. Bellona is exclusively an Italian goddess of war. She's not Greek at all. The others all have Greek counterparts. And the presence of Discord, in particular, makes this battle appear to be a civil war, which, of course, in some ways, it is. Notice how different Virgil's presentation is from Horace's. Horace leaves Antony out of the picture. He makes it all on Cleopatra. It's not remotely a civil war. But Virgil treads a lot closer to the line. He does show Antony. I mean, Antony's been corrupted, and he's backed by non-Roman gods, but he's still there. And the presence of Discord is very telling. This is absolutely, even if subtly, a civil war. And the shield shows two sides of Rome, both war and peace. The scenes of the shield are not actually really those which are important for praising Augustus. They're the scenes that are important for praising Rome as a whole. But if Rome is the teleological goal of the Aeneid, and remember, teleological means the ultimate purposeful endpoint, Augustus, who's at the center of the shield, appears to be the teleological goal of the shield. He is the culmination of all of these scenes of history. He, in some ways, is the final important point in Rome's history. This is what Virgil is implying. But of course, there are inevitably contradictions, as Chris mentioned on Wednesday. And they are right here embedded in this glorification of Augustus. War is the antithesis of peace, but peace can only come about through war. Yes, all of Augustus's wars are just, but there's still wars. They still cause bloodshed. Some of them were really actually against Romans and not just the one against Antony. When he goes and he kills Brutus and Cassius and all of the other conspirators who killed his father, those are Romans, even if they're nasty, horrible Romans who we don't like. And these are the two sides of Rome that we can see on the shield, and these are the two sides of Augustus's rule. Finally, we get Rome's world dominion. The final image on the shield is Augustus's triple triumph after the Battle of Actium. Book 7 had ended with the vast plethora of Italian peoples all coming together. Book 8 ends with the vast plethora of Roman peoples under the empire. We move from this fractured multiplicity of Italy, it can't even be one unified Roman Italy, to a completely unified world, unified by Augustus, by the end of Book 8. And really, this is the astounding success of Augustus. And despite all of the contradictions inherent, this really is worthy of praise. And we can see that as we move from Book 7 to Book 8, that Augustus is amazing because he has done something amazing, even if he's not perfect.